My laboratory in the castle east, to the master bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. Today's program is a panel discussion.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us today are John Whalen. He served with the city's land use director in the 1980s and led the adoption of the Land Use Ordinance, or the LUO, which is the present structure for the city's residential zoning controls. Back then, they called those large houses McMansions, and they began appearing in the more affluent suburban residential neighborhoods. And in response, the city required more off-street parking. Also in studio today is Evan Fujimoto, president of Graham Builders and the former president of the Building Industry Association of Hawaii. The BIA fears a rush to put a moratorium in place could have unintentional consequences for homeowners and builders.
Joining us by phone is council member Kimberly Marcos Pine, chair of the City Council Zoning and Housing Committee. She represents areas like Waipahu and Ewa, where large houses have evolved in response to house multi-generational families. If you haven't guessed by now, our subject is monster houses. The phone numbers we're asking you to call are 941-3689 on Oahu, or on neighbor islands, 1-877-941-3689.
Welcome to all of you this morning. John Whalen, you have a long view of the land use ordinance. You know, you're a planner. Do you agree that we need a moratorium before the density in these older neighborhoods gets out of hand? Do we need a monster mash?
Well, I think it's a good idea to get a handle on what's happening, because houses have gotten increasingly large. It's not as if it's very widespread at this point, but the cumulative effect of having these large houses in residential neighborhoods that weren't really designed to accommodate so many large residences and a high number of occupants can be a big concern, and not just for the sewer and water infrastructure, but stormwater runoff. For example, there's more paving on a lot. And in older parts of Honolulu in particular, that is a big concern, because even following current code, some of these neighborhoods are stressed in terms of their infrastructure. So if that trend towards larger and larger houses continues, we could have other problems arise that were unanticipated.
How long has that current code been in place?
It was adopted in 1986. Many of the provisions actually carried over from the previous zoning code, the Comprehensive Zoning Code. The LUO, or Land Use Ordinance, has been amended many times, and this would be one of the amendments that's anticipated. Right now, I think this proposed moratorium isn't attempting to get things completely settled. It's just a stopgap until Department of Planning and Permitting and the City Council takes a closer look at what might be most effective for regulating large houses, looking at the balance of things, you know, the demand for, you know, housing for multi-generational families, but also the protection of not just neighborhoods. I'm not talking about neighborhood characters so much as what the infrastructure capacity is to accommodate these large dwellings.
And Council Member Kim Pine, the council is going to take up this issue tomorrow, and you've got about, I think, six or seven different amendments, floor amendments, to the initial bill that was proposed a few months back. You're going to have a long meeting tomorrow.
It's very clear that we are rushing things, and it's highly unusual to have six different amendments on final reading. Usually you take care of all your disagreements or misunderstandings in the committee, but the planning committee wanted to take this on, and certainly I gave it to them, and they realized that it's a lot more complicated than they thought. In December, when it was held in, we discussed this in my committee, the zoning committee, we passed out a resolution directing DPP to process a proposed LUO amendment that intended to really look at the numbers. You know, I think what was happening, people were just looking at certain houses, but they weren't really analyzing, okay, how did it get that big? How many bedrooms? How many baths? Are they really multifamily? And so we gave it to them to truly give us numbers and statistics that would show, okay, this is what a monster house is. This is not a multifamily. This is being used for multiple rentals to different people or vacation rentals. And so I think we were moving fine, and all of a sudden the moratorium came up, and as you hear, I'm sure, from the BIA, it's a lot more complicated because we could potentially destroy 25% of our economy overnight. Small contractors and architects could, you know, lose their businesses and their homes just like that because they specialize in just building family homes. And so I think we need a lot more thought put into it by the planners. You know, sometimes when politicians get involved, it messes everything up, and smart people like John Whelan, you know, who know this stuff, should be the ones leading the discussion and not necessarily us.
And Evan, you met with the mayor yesterday to express some of your concerns. Share that with our listeners.
Yes, we did. Good morning. Our conversation focused primarily on enforcement. Representing our industry, we do feel that a lot of the amendments that have been proposed will put some pretty onerous restrictions on building larger multi-generational homes. And really, we're trying to focus, we hope the government would focus on those few bad eggs that are essentially building apartment buildings being masqueraded as single-family homes in residential areas. And he did make us aware of the difficulties in enforcement. Of course, we have a very difficult vacation rental problem in a lot of communities, and just getting a handle on that's tough. They don't have enough inspectors to handle this volume of work. They don't have all the tools necessarily or the right actually to go in and inspect properties. You know, they have to give notices, and I'm not sure exactly how much time is allotted or given a homeowner to make corrections or to even allow an inspector in. But, you know, we as contractors, we deal with inspectors from HIOSH, from OSHA, and they can come on our projects and inspect for safety violations and things like that. So, you know, it can be done, in our opinion. We just hope that more of the attention or the focus would really be on enforcement. It's just it's sad that there are these people that are intent their intentions are to break the rules no matter what. So no matter what you throw out there, they're going to find a way of working around that and still coming up with large homes and cutting them up into, you know, maybe bedrooms that are as small as 9 by 9. And having, you know, 10 wet bars in a house and 17 bathrooms and all of that. So how do you really stop them? And I think that's really where the focus needs to be.
Evan, you're kind of saying that there's no sense in passing additional laws, ordinances, if existing ones aren't being enforced.
Exactly. You know, so when we look at the additional setbacks, for example, if you the council is now looking at a 70% what they call FAR, or floor area ratio. And what this means is you take your lot size and you multiply that by 0.7. So let's say the typical Kaimuki Kapahulu 5,000 square foot lot, it's a 50 by 100 lot. So a 0.7 FAR would mean you could build up to 3,500 square feet and still just have to abide by the current codes and ordinances for setbacks and height envelopes and things like that. But if you exceed that FAR, then you're now you have to you'll be limited now by more setback, more parking requirements, and things like that, which will make it very difficult for a lot of families. You know, our company builds homes for local families, a lot of multi-generational households. You've probably read that as many as 12 to 14% of some communities are multi-generational households. So it's a very common thing now, you know, a lot of this, I think, is symptomatic of a broken housing policy overall. When it's so difficult for developers to be able to bring new product to market, when it takes a large developer like Castle & Cook to go through 15 years of entitlements, it really restricts supply. And so that's why families are forced to live together, because they just can't afford to buy their own homes. So they're cohabitating. And I've done jobs where sometimes there's four generations under one roof, and it's all one family, and they're not cutting up their homes illegally. You know, they're just all living together, and sometimes we talk about multi-generational households as being either the one pot of rice family or the two pots of rice families. The one pot of rice, everybody kind of lives together and eats together. The others live separately. You know, maybe grandma, grandpa downstairs and the rest of the family's upstairs and kind of do their own things. But they're all living within a single family dwelling.
And you live in a multi-generational home.
Yes, I do. You know, my parents moved in with us about 3.5 years ago.
Let's get some listeners to weigh in on this. Our numbers are, if you're on Oahu, 941-3689. If you're on a neighbor island, 1-877-941-3689. Our subject is so-called monster homes. Is there one in your neighborhood? Have you been affected by it? Do you perhaps live in one? We'd like to hear from you.
And joining us in studio this morning are John Whalen, the former land use director for the city, as well as Trevor from the Building Industry Association, and Councilmember Kim Pine, who is joining us by phone.
Councilmember Pine, you heard Evan Fujimoto's comments from the Building Industry Association.
Yes.
How do you feel about that? Enforcement versus new ordinances.
Well, I actually agree with him, and it was something that I recommended when we passed the original resolution. And the department was saying, well, we have to give this many days notice, and so by the time we come back, they fix everything. And I said, well, why don't you give no notice? Give them time to get their things together, and why don't we focus on changing that part? And they said they can look into that. And so we were going into that direction, and then the moratorium bill started coming up. And this is because a lot of these council members are getting a lot of pressure from their communities who – I've been shown you have these 20-bedroom homes and 10 baths. It's hard not to feel sympathetic to a family that lives in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, single-wall construction home right next to that home. And so we definitely know that those homes are doing illegal activity. We've found cases where they're doing B&B, where we found ads. We found cases where those monster homes are actually doing businesses and taking up all the parking. And so we all agree they're all illegal activities. Why don't we focus on enforcement? And so I think we really need to certainly go after the illegal activity and give more tools to DPP to be able to do that.
We've got a caller on the line who I think is talking about something you just referred to, Councilmember Pine. Jennifer from Honolulu, can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, this is Jennifer. I'm sorry I didn't hear what the councilwoman said because I had to turn my radio off, but I really wanted to say that I wish that the homes weren't being referred to as monster homes just because of the negative connotations. I don't think they're all bad. Some are ugly, some are people breaking the rules, but some are multifamily homes and people saved up all their money all their lives to build. So they shouldn't all be considered evil, like monster. And the other thing is, there's in my neighborhood, there's a bunch of houses that are built right on the beach that are, you know, right up to the legal property line, which in my opinion is, you know, way too close to the beach. And they're huge homes for two people or for a small family or for a movie star rental, and it's also a mega house that it doesn't serve the purposes of a community. It serves the purposes of one person.
Jennifer, thanks for checking in with us.
John Whalen, you were shaking your head when Kim Pine was talking about the process and some of the things that the council has tried to grapple with.
I don't think the inspector can just show up without notice to inspect a house. They have to get permission to gain entry to the house. It's a due process question. The city can't enforce regulations just at their own will. They have to follow certain procedures, and they can't make unreasonable searches and seizures, for example. So That's what the frustration, I think, that many people see is that there are illegal activities going on, and it's not just in construction. It's in all sorts of things. And the government has certain limits, which are good that the government has those limits on enforcement, but it makes enforcement more complicated.
You mentioned earlier that the concern about these homes was triggered. The land use ordinance that was put in place back when you were a land use director, you'd mentioned that the enforcement program was put in there for a certain reason.
Right. Well, when I was in the Department of Land Utilization, initially all the enforcement was through the criminal code. And that was so ineffectual because essentially prosecutors didn't want to take up cases of violation. When they did, they brought them to the criminal courts. Criminal courts weren't interested in imposing criminal-type penalties, and they didn't offer any kind of correction to the violation, which is really the point. It's not as if building is criminal in nature. It's more of a civil enforcement issue. So before I left the city, we amended the land use ordinance to create a new civil fine enforcement system. That's been certainly more effective than the previous criminal enforcement, but it's still complicated because you still have to go through due process, allow for appeals, and go through everything that would be constitutionally correct, and not just enter into require a building be demolished or corrected immediately. The owner has a right to an appeal process, so it takes time sometimes to enforce.
So, is it really ineffective, the system that we've got now?
I wouldn't say it's ineffective. It's certainly more effective than it used to be. But I don't know how you would really change it to speed up the enforcement process. One of the high-profile cases that we faced when I was at the city was the Daiwan Sa Temple. I think it's gotten, in fact, actually in case law, it's often cited as an example of how difficult enforcement can be or how long it will take. Eventually it does work, but it can't work immediately because in that case it went through various appeals processes, even for arguing that it was constitutionally protected because it was a religious institution. So it took I don't know how many years altogether, but it was probably about 10 years before effective enforcement was made.
And for our listeners, that temple is a Korean temple in Pololo Valley. And I believe, if my memory serves me right, that they built higher than they should have, and you ordered them to tear it down.
They built an extra floor
yeah.
Over above the height limit. It was a complicated case, but it was, again, an example of the builder refusing to stop. They just continued in the construction. And it's always more difficult to enforce after the fact because, you know, there are consequences, certainly cost consequences.
Tearing down what you've just built.
Yes.
And I know Council Member Ann Kobayashi suggested maybe we ought to go back and be a little bit more draconian to kind of show some of these bad apples that, no, you can't just, you know, thumb your nose at the city and just disregard our rules. So while there are folks that are saying we need to focus on enforcement, in some ways the city's hands are tied because it's so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
There's a caller on the line referring to one of the corollary issues, which is the area surrounding the home. Joan from Kailua, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Tell me what's on your mind.
Well, I live in an old area in Kailua, the Kialu Hills,
mm-hmm.
and the streets are very narrow. And there are renters, multifamily units, and there's no place to to park. They don't have large garages, or because it's multiple cars. People park everywhere on the so-called unimproved sidewalk, on the street, and it's a safety issue. There is just no place to walk except in the middle of the road.
Doesn't sound like there's any place to park either.
Yeah, we had one renter, a multifamily, and they had 13 vehicles. 13. It looked horrible, but we need police enforcement. We really do, to encourage people to either enlarge their garages or just deal with the situation, because it is truly a safety situation.
Joan, have you or your neighbors called the police?
Yes. Yep.
What happens?
Nothing.
Well, somebody comes to talk to you. What do they say?
They say, well, one police officer said, yeah, I have the problem where I live. And it doesn't solve it. Our councilman, Ikaka Anderson, really needs to address this, because as more and more people move in, it's becoming increasingly difficult. It doesn't look so bad during the daytime, but when people come home from work, oh, my goodness. And it's really unfair to those who need to walk on the on the so-called sidewalk.
Joan, thanks very much for checking in with us. I think this describes the problem that a lot of people are. This is exactly what's bringing this issue to a head. Problems like the ones that she's describing. Yeah,
I'd say that's a good example of the cumulative effect of increasing density on particularly older streets. There can be tragic consequences. Also, in the 1980s, when I was at working with the city, there was a fire that broke out in Liliha neighborhood. It had very narrow streets, and there were so many cars parked on the road that the fire trucks couldn't gain access.
We've seen, both Catherine and I have seen numerous examples of that.
And a child died. And that actually spurred an improvement project in that neighborhood, just to widen the streets at least enough so that a fire truck could get through there. But it still makes it difficult if cars are parked along that street to get a full fire truck through. So they actually had to put in a fire hydrant or two fire hydrants in there, so they could better protect the houses that were there.
Councilmember Pine, I know we only have you for about another 15 minutes. I just want to make sure we didn't leave you behind. You heard the caller from Kailua talk about the 13 cars in one home.
Oh, yes. That's very prevalent in my Ebba Beach part of my community, and then, of course, some places in Waianae. And this is just a result of lack of affordable housing, and that's a bigger issue that we're also trying to tackle in my community. And I do respect Mr. Whalen's comments about due process, and I'm certainly not advocating for eliminating that. But the waiting period is quite long before you, when you get that first notice and then they come back. It's enough time to completely clear off all your kitchens and things like that. And that seems to be one of the problems. We are trying to tackle the vacation rental issue. But we've heard so many different complaints about this issue, and what it comes down to is that people are using these homes for illegal activity. And we need to somehow find a way to increase our enforcement. I know it's very hard, but doing more serious things where we're actually, hurting our economy and even hurting local families from just trying to survive here. If we do it wrong, there's dire consequences. We certainly are going to pass some type of a moratorium bill, and it's my hope that we can at least agree on something, and that seems to be the problem right now with the rush process that Bill 110 has been put through.
DPP Director Kathy Sokugawa talked to us yesterday. She acknowledged that the administration now recognizes that something needs to be done. The moratorium bill would be in place for up to 2 years until the city can make the fixes to the land use ordinance.
There's a spike in these large homes. There's clearly some market forces at work here that's of grave concern. And if you do drive around certain neighborhoods, they certainly have been changing the character of the neighborhood. So we support the moratorium, and we do want to work expeditiously on the permanent solution.
If you're just joining us, our guests in our studio are John Whalen, the head of the HCDA and former land use director of the city, Building Industry Association, former industry president Evan Fujimoto, and planning chair council member Kimberly Pine.
The numbers we're asking you to call are 941-3689, are from Neighbor Islands, 1-877-941-3689. And here's a written question from Ron in Honolulu. Is there a revenue source to hire more inspectors and code enforcers? That interesting question, Councilmember Pine.
Yes, the council members have advocated for years to increase their budget, but, you know, typical of any administration, you're trying to save money. And every year that I've been in the council, they've refused the additional money for inspectors, unless it was for the solar industry at that one point where we had this huge backlog. And so I think this issue has brought to light that whether the administration wants us to increase their number of inspectors or not, that the council is going to budget this item, because it's very clear that there needs to be more staffing if enforcement is already so hard.
Has this been a one of these cases where an issue has kind of gotten out of control, where more timely addressing of that a few years back might have kept a problem from growing the way it has been?
I believe so. And just hearing all the testimony from all those longtime residents that are so distraught that all of a sudden there's this 10,000-square-foot lot that has this massive home next to their three-bedroom little house. You know, their stories is that we call the inspectors and they don't come in time. And by the time that they do come back, they already removed things or there's construction going on inside. And so we definitely need to focus on, you know, why can't we do better enforcement in the time period? Is it that we need to have them come more rapidly, more repeatedly, or are they overwhelmed? And so we definitely need to help in this area in any way that we can.
This is a very complex issue because I know in Palolo Valley where there were homes that were torn down, and then you've got these monsters, if you will, and then the homes are then flipped and selling for close to $2 million, and then that's driving up the real property tax rates, which we saw when we had the Japanese bubble, you know, back in the 80s, and there were attempts back then to try and do something to help the residents who live in the little plantation houses who can't afford to see their real property taxes go up because they don't plan to live anywhere else. They just want to stay there and live out their lives on their land.
Mm-hmm.
You remember those times, John?
Yes, I remember lots of times.
Now, I do want to just point out some of the consequences of us not getting this right. And, you know, we were just looking at different lots all over the place. And, for example, in Laliha, for example, they have smaller lots. And we found homes where their FAR is 8.4. And that's because you have people, like you just said, wanting to live there forever, and their family members can't afford to live anywhere else, so they add a room. You know, next generation, you add a room. And so these old plantation-era homes would all be considered a non-conforming, which, as John knows, that causes complication for that homeowner when they want to sell their house or refinance their loan. Some of the proposals that are being made tomorrow is to have a 7-foot setback. And those older plantation-era style homes are certainly not going to be able to have that. I looked at some lots in my neighborhood. Some have really skinny, long lots. And so they literally would be considered a non-conforming home, and they would have to chop off a foot on each side. And so I think Evan probably would be able to explain some of the complication of the setback proposals a little better than I can.
Well, yes, I mean, setbacks are difficult to deal with, especially with larger homes. But I did want to address, first of all, Joan had called in earlier about the parking issue, and to address that, you know, one of the things that the design and construction community can do to be proactive about this is to encourage homeowners to provide more off-street parking and to utilize it. We're currently working on a project in Pearl City. It's a new home. It'll be a multi-generational home. And the homeowners made it clear to us that they wanted to be able to park four vehicles on their property. So the driveway will be large enough to accomplish that. And oftentimes there is adequate space to do it, but it's just not made a priority. So, you know, we should be proactive in that area and just, you know, take the initiative. With regard to setbacks, we currently have a ordinances where it requires a 10-foot front setback and 5 feet on the sides and rear. And what's being proposed that these setbacks be increased to either 7 feet, 9 feet, or even 11 feet, depending on the size of the home. And so it gets very difficult. The most difficult part of the new law that's being proposed are the parking requirements and the fact that you have to be able to exit the property in a forward manner. So they would not allow, I guess, tandem parking and things like that, or you'd have to have adequate turnaround space at the front, which makes it very difficult when you have a pie-shaped lot, and especially when it's on a slope, because, you know, the steeper the slope is, you're dealing with not only your side setbacks but height envelopes. And so to fit your house on a slope is somewhat tricky. And if you have to force the homeowner to push the house further down the slope to create more available parking area, it would then require large retaining walls, and it would force the home to be stair-stepped down. And so you imagine you're trying to create a multi-generational household and you have elderly living in the home, and now you're saying, okay, you're going to have to walk down a bunch of steps just to get to your house. You know, it's very possible that could happen. So you have to be very careful when you start increasing setbacks, when you look at all the different lot shapes and topography out there.
And Councilmember Trevor Ozawa, who represents East Honolulu, was one of the first to raise the red flag about these apartments that are masquerading as single-family homes. Residents, particularly in Kaimuki and Palolo, were particularly vocal because of the rate of building and the perception that third-party reviewers were rubber-stamping projects and finding loopholes to max out a lot.
I don't want to tell people that, you know, the city's here to tell you what you have to build, but we certainly have to tell people what they can't build. And when they can't build, what they can't build are things that are just disrupting and overloading our infrastructure, our parking, our sewage, the general character of the neighborhoods, and the sense of place that some of these older neighborhoods have, and the charm that they once had.
That was Trevor Ozawa talking about the problems in his district.
There's a caller on the line. Max from Honolulu has a comment on that. Max, can you hear me?
Hi.
Yo, what's on your mind?
My question was, these parkings.
Max, I need you to start over.
Issue from the homeless being shipped here and left in our care, and most of them have mental illnesses.
Max, I'm going to ask you to hang up and call again. We're getting really poor audio quality on your call. Let's go to another line. Shannon from Kaimuki. Shannon?
Hi. I was just calling to speak with or bring up something, I think, regarding a lot of the conversation that we hear about is, one, goes down a path of being punitive, thinking about ways of punishing people who are trying to build these large homes or possibly who have these rentals and gaming the system. But at the same time, it doesn't seem like you're really answering the source of where these homes are coming from, which is meeting a demand. I mean, as much as I don't want to see unsightly or ungainly things in my neighborhood, I also recognize that there's people need housing, and we're not building enough of it, and we're not, our city and our process doesn't encourage small builders and small developers to do so. And then, you know, you have in this case, you have people who are doing large monster homes, but the homes are getting sold, and they're not getting sold to high-end individuals per se. They're getting home to people who you have saved up, and they're happy to have a product where their family can live in, or they can rent out part of it to afford it. But part of the affordability is because we're not getting enough homes out there, and everything is so restrictive that it makes it very difficult. Maybe, I know you've got one of the guests there, someone who helped create the LUOs that we currently use, but perhaps we should be reevaluating the effectiveness of our current LUOs to our housing demand. and that there need to be, you know, more pathways for people to create more living space. Because if you just keep coming up with solutions that are going to be restrictive or punishing, then all you're going to do is continue to drive up home pricing. And that's going to make it difficult for our residents to find places to live or be able to afford the homes that they do live in now.
Well,
I'd like to hear some comments on that. Thank you.
The LUO has been amended several times to increase housing availability. Ohana housing is an option available to many of the homeowners, and also accessory dwelling units, which is a relatively new provision that was added to the LUO. So the problem is that it's a question of fit. Because even with respect to the setback requirements, the current LUO has not just the standard 10 and 5-foot setbacks, but because these houses are getting so large, they have additional setbacks even under the current code because of the height. And some of that, those setbacks are needed for fire safety reasons. So I think if you link back these standards to public health and safety, it becomes important because it's not just a matter of building houses, but making sure that people have safe places to live and in neighborhoods where we don't have cars blocking fire trucks for access for fire safety, for example.
There was one home in Palolo, I know, that was up for sale, and when I called the realtor, they said that they were marketing it for the homeowner as a care home property. Mm-hmm. And I think it had 17 bedrooms, 15 baths, and the fire department, I know, expressed some concern because they said if it's being used as a care home, there are certain rules that they're bound by. You know, it's got to have sprinklers and good access. Because if you have elderly residents in there, it could be tragic if there's a fire.
That's great.
Councilmember Pine, I know we only got you for another minute or so on the phone. Any final thoughts?
Well, we'll see what happens tomorrow. I sure hope for those families that are tragically suffering in their communities from these monster homes that are especially doing illegal activity that we can find a solution for them. But I hope for the sake of people who are just trying to find housing that we come up with a decision that doesn't hurt them. And that's the complexity of this issue. And so I urge patience for my council members as we have more thoughtful discussion on this issue. We're very close, I believe, to coming up with something. I just don't know if it's going to be tomorrow. But thank you for allowing me to be involved in this discussion.
Council member, you're optimistic?
I'm optimistic. You know, we just got to get some egos out of there and, you know, get some intellectual thought in there and have more of our planners step up with the better solutions. And I think that we'll do the right thing. At least I'm hopeful.
Thanks for joining us on the program, Councilman.
Aloha, everyone.
John, any thoughts? Sounds like they want to do something. Do you think that we need to put the brakes on it while we make the fixes with the LUO?
Well, the point of a moratorium is timeliness. We don't have to have a perfect bill at this point. It's just to, again, allow some time for this discussion to continue. I can't see how this moratorium would shut things down so precipitously that you can't come up with something for a more permanent solution that would work. I think that they're generally pretty reasonable allowances for building larger homes, even in this moratorium, and if it's not meant to be permanent.
I know the I think original bill had called for some relief valve, and I think the city administration was saying, well, you know, we don't want to really go that route because I think they were afraid that there was going to be that they wouldn't have the staff to deal with that. But I think they're a proposal of a 0.7 floor ratio, I think, was something that they're pushing. And you mentioned that the BIA could maybe live with that.
Well, it's the least onerous of all the recommendations being put forth. It's unfortunate, though, because even with that, there are a number of builder members in our association who will be directly impacted by that. They have homeowners or projects in process right now in design that will have to be redesigned. And they have families that have been saving a lot of money for a long time that are now going to have to not shelve the project but go back to square one and rethink things. And so there's a lot of cost and time involved, and it will impact them. The sad thing, though, is that none of this is really going to impact the people that are building these monster homes. And I like to, I do like what that call, the first caller, I believe her name was Jennifer, said that, you know, they're not all monster homes. Many of them are large, but they're families just living in there together, you know. That's been our experience with our company and many of our members. It's the same. It's really, and I don't really know what the data shows in terms of how many actual homes are out there that would come under this monster home classification that are actually apartment buildings that are just being rented out. You know, the renting rooms, is it less than 20? I'm not sure. You know, with regard to enforcement, in our meeting with the mayor yesterday, Greg Thielen, who's a general contractor, and his business focuses mostly on luxury homes. But he did mention to the mayor that California has a very effective enforcement program whereby they were able to change some laws and get police powers so that the building department inspectors, police, and some other agencies team together, and the fines are pretty severe, and this is a revenue-positive program. So it doesn't cost the government anything. They actually make money on this, and that's what funds that whole program. So he promised to get more information on that to the mayor, and hopefully that would be a part of the discussions tomorrow as well.
John, what are your thoughts on the fines?
Well, sometimes it's a matter of collecting them, too. It depends. I mean, if you have some really intransigent violator of a code, it's very difficult to get them to comply. There are some people that are just very, very difficult, the most, I guess, resistant to making even corrections or collection of fines or paying the fines.
And the genesis of the fines, can you share with our listeners how that came about?
The original, the purpose was to put pressure on the property owner to comply with the code. That's really, it wasn't to
make money.
To make money, yeah. It was just to get compliance with the code. Because, you know, it's not something that should be a revenue generator per se, just to be able to pay for the cost of enforcement.
John, there's a caller on the line with a question that relates directly to that. Cameron from downtown Honolulu.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Sure. So I wanted to let everyone know that there's a bill called SB 2092 that makes it unlawful to lie or mislead county housing inspectors. And we've seen the issue where both with monster homes and illegal vacation rentals that simply by misstating that you are, or yeah, by lying to our county inspectors, you're able to get out of the citation for illegal vacation rentals. So that is a huge issue. And there's a hearing for that bill this Thursday.
So currently you can lie to an inspector?
Yes, there's no statute that explicitly prohibits this. We've spoken to the Kauai housing people as well, and they tried to prosecute this, but because there was no specific offense where it said this was unlawful, they were unable to do that, or they're having trouble getting the prosecutorial attention as well as the police investigation into when they're lying to them.
Evan Fujimoto of the Building Industry Association. Again, we're at enforcement, aren't we?
We really are. You know, and I understand the realities of having an adequate number of inspectors and how do you actually execute on this. But, you know, the mayor was very interested in what Greg mentioned about California's program. So I personally don't know too many of the details of how that all works. But I do know that they had to pass new laws that gave the counties and I guess the state, you know, they could combine their powers together and be able to enforce laws more vigorously. And apparently they're doing a good job at it. And the fines I've heard are very severe.
I believe the bills that their caller had mentioned, they may have been introduced by former council member Stanley Chang, now senator, and then also Representative Calvin Say. There were concerns about, I think, vacation rentals, at least for Stanley Chang. I know he's lived next to a couple of homes that he said used to house local families, and then overnight when their lease ended, they became whole house vacation rentals. And he saw the problems with that firsthand. And the problem of enforcement, whether it's vacation rentals or monster homes, I think is the genesis of those bills at the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Peter from Kaneohe has a comment. Peter?
Hi. First, I would like to thank you for hosting this conversation.
Peter, I can't hear you. Start over.
Hello?
Peter, start over. I didn't hear you. I had a bad connection.
Oh, I wanted to thank you for hosting this conversation because I think it's a really important topic. And I think that we're also scratching at a kind of larger political issue. Hawaii is quickly becoming a place where soon only the ultra-wealthy will be able to own property. In part, this is from wealthy investors, often foreign investors, that come in and purchase property in Hawaii, effectively pushing out its own residents.
Peter, I'm going to paraphrase what you just said because, Peter, I'm sorry, your audio level is so bad I don't think anybody would be able to hear you, but what you just said was that the prices are going higher and higher and people are getting priced out of the market.
Dollars, people could quickly buy up their property and push the local residents, the Thai residents, out. I'm wondering if there's any thought around this kind of legislation here in Hawaii that would prevent foreign money from driving Hawaii residents out of their own homes and out of the possibility of owning property or even renting property.
Foreign money, we've heard that a great deal over the years, haven't we, John?
In the 1980s, yes. Yeah, former Mayor Fossey had proposed limitations on foreign investment in property. That's when there was the bubble economy that affected land prices.
Prices really took off in the 80s.
Yeah, they did. But obviously that legislation didn't pass.
Right, and now we're seeing with some of these so-called monster houses, I think it's Chinese money. In some cases that we've looked at. So obviously no quick fix, no solution, very complex issue. And I think it goes back to enforcement.
It seems to, Evan Fujimoto.
Well, so when you look at the housing market overall, you know, a vibrant housing market has to have a supply at all price points. And I know the luxury market often gets attacked because it's the most visible. You have these high rises in Kaka'ako. They're, you know, gleaming towers of glass, and they get all the attention. And yes, they do have a lot of foreign investors, but there are also a lot of local people that buy these units. And what happens is when somebody that perhaps is living in Mililani and has been there for 30-something years and their home is paid off and maybe now they're older and they want to be in town, they sell their home, they buy one of these units in Kaka'ako, which opens up their home for somebody from another family to purchase. And so it just works its way all the way down the line. You know, my son attends college in the state of Arizona in Phoenix. And, you know, I've been there several times. And, you know, they have a very healthy housing market, which basically means there's something for everybody at practically every price point. So if you're a student and you can only afford $500-$600 a month to rent a little place, you can find that. If you want to buy a $30 million home, you can probably find that too. And there's something in between for everybody. Now, granted, they have a lot more available land, but a lot of it is because housing policy has always been very a main priority for that state. They invest heavily in infrastructure, in highways, in water, and wastewater. A few months ago, the Gates Foundation announced that they are working with a development company and they are going to be building a massive new housing project. This is just west of Phoenix. I don't know the name of the actual area. They're also going to be, redirecting part of the freeway that goes through that area and as it turns north up toward Vegas. But this new community, with the backing of the Gates Foundation, is going to invest billions of dollars to create a city of the future that has a lot of connectivity, data centers, walking spaces, where you know a lot of this mixed-use urban planning. And so they're very forward in their thinking. And what often you see here in Hawaii, where it's just so difficult to build anything. And so even with these new rules coming in that they're proposing, if you limit the size of the home, it just means that the same number of people are going to live in these homes but in much smaller rooms, or they're going to be sleeping on couches. You know, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And they'll be parking further away from the house. And it's just sad because if we were able to build to meet the demand, then you really wouldn't see much of this, as much of this as you do see it right now.
That's Evan Fujimoto of the Building Industry Association. And John Whalen, we've got about a minute left. Any you know, do you see a solution that hasn't been addressed here? Is there something that we haven't thought about in the course of our discussion?
Well, I do believe that we do need to build a variety of housing types. And I think that we do need to also make sure that the neighborhoods where we build these new housing units are livable and safe neighborhoods that the infrastructure is able to support these new housing units.
Well, thank you very much, John and Evan, for joining us on this show today. We would also like to thank Kim Pine for joining us. And we thank you, the listener, for being here and participating in our roundtable on this show today.
We've been joined by Councilmember Kimberly Pine, former HCDA Chair John Whalen, and Evan Fujimoto, former president of the Building Industry Association. If your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact our talkback line and leave comments at this number, 808-792-8217.
You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.